Trying to think of a clever way to begin this one. But I can't.
Fuck that. I don't care about podcasts.
I'm yeah.
Some kind of jerk who doesn't care about anything.
Whatever.
I hate, and that's what I do.
I don't even hate, man. I just don't care. Hi. That's really not true, because here we are, obviously.
We care.
Yeah, at least a little bit. Enough to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. This is Does It Matter?
Yeah.
Another episode?
Indeed. That was a belt.
Things are just falling onto the floor.
Uh-huh. I'm Alex, that's Ben.
Here we are.
And this week we are covering the subject of anti-heroes.
Yes. Anti-heroes, if you're unfamiliar with the term, anti-hero refers to some sort of a figure who is, while the protagonist, has none of the qualities that would actually make someone a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Think modern television.
Pretty much, yeah. Which we were kind of joking about on the way in here, neither of us did.
Yeah, as it turns out, television is just lousy with anti-heroes.
Yeah.
So we tried to avoid that and instead went with more interesting interpretations of the topic.
I guess, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Such as, do you want to start?
Or sure.
Okay, go for it.
The first example of an anti-hero I decided to go with is sort of the most direct application of the concept of anti-hero.
Okay.
Looking at a character who has negative qualities, who is still our protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with a film that came out in 2014 called Nightcrawler.
Ah, yes.
Nightcrawler was written and directed by a guy named Dan Gilroy, who is generally known as being the cinematographer for Paul Thomas Anderson's movies.
Oh, I didn't think I realized that.
Yeah, a little bit of connection there.
Yeah.
It stars Jake Gyllenhaal primarily. It's very much a single character focused film, but it also has notable roles by Rene Russo, Riz Ahmed, and Bill Paxton. It's basically based on the premise of doing a character portrait of someone who is an anti-hero. It does, however, have a plot, and that plot is a little bit difficult to explain, and I'll get into that in a second.
Mm.
A couple other fun facts about the movie. Roger Ebert once called it the best motion picture that Michael Mann never made.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
And it was a movie that came out and got a lot of critical praise, but in a move that I think is not typical for a movie that gets a lot of critical praise, the critics couldn't agree on what it is that they were actually praising. Some people thought that it was a movie that it was like a cultural critique. Some people thought it was more of like an action thriller. Other people thought they were praising it because it was a movie that just did a fantastic job of making you feel exactly what you're supposed to feel.
It is a hard movie to pin down.
Yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal and actually disagreed on what the general genre of the film was. Gilroy was like, "Oh, well, it's a thriller," and Jake Gyllenhaal's like, "No, it's a black comedy."
That explains a lot.
yeah. So you can sort of see if you have seen it, I'm sure both of those things make sense in their twisted kind of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the general plot of Nightcrawler. There's a guy, his name is Lou Bloom. He doesn't have a job, but very early in the film, he witnesses a TV crew filming the aftermath of a car accident. Mm-hmm. And curious about that, he asks one of the people doing it who they're shooting for, and a couple details about what it is specifically that they're doing. And he finds out that they are freelance news journalists, essentially. But what they really do is they track down grisly accidents, film them, and then sell them to news outlets.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Mr. Bloom, sets to stealing a bicycle so that he can buy a camcorder and a police scanner, And as he gets better and better at it, he keeps on buying better and better materials. He enlists the help of someone who is... It's not really clear what Riz Ahmed's character is like outside of the film. It seems like he's down on his luck at the very least. Yeah. He doesn't seem homeless, but he does get roped into, like, being the assistant to Mr. Bloom.
Yeah, I definitely got... Like, I don't remember his character that well, but I definitely remember a sense of resistance on his part.
Yeah, he acts as sort of the moral voice, mm-hmm. where Lou Bloom is really the culmination of every negative quality that you could describe about American society. Here's someone who is not empathetic at all, completely willing to let other people get hurt in order to get ahead on whatever it is that he's trying to get ahead on. He puts himself first in literally every situation. So there's this ever-present escalation of the stakes in this movie, even though you're just primarily watching him get certain accidents on film and then showing them to a news team. Every scene is somehow more upsetting in some way than the last.
Yeah.
And it's done in a very careful, calculated way, so that you are pretty much always riveted watching. There's no moment where you're like, oh, okay, well, this is a down moment before something else happens. Something yeah. is already happening.
Yeah, sometimes you're like not even sure exactly what's happening.
Right. The true draw of the film for me is trying to figure out exactly who Lou Bloom is. You want to find the extent of what his morality or lack thereof is. You want to figure out what his philosophy is. One of the most chilling lines, as far as I'm concerned, is he talks about being up late at night. And I believe it's Rene Russo's character asks him, like, what is it that you do at night? And he just replies, I plan.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, it's inherently pretty off-putting. And so, I want to know, what are his plans?
Yeah.
If this is something that he's so...
What actually drives him.
Yeah. Everything that you find out about him, you find out in very piecemeal fashion, where each revelation sort of ratchets the stakes even higher than they already were. But like I was saying with what the critics thought, it's simultaneously a critique of news outlets, American values, and the viewing public. One of the things that's really intriguing about Lou Bloom as an anti-hero is all of his qualities become a criticism of the values that he endorses. So as you're watching him descend ever further into this really dark world that he's partially creating, you are learning the point the film is trying to make, but through a very sort of stilted, like, funhouse mirror kind of fashion.
Yeah, demonstration by its opposite.
Right. It's kind of difficult to convey specifically how the atmosphere of the film functions, so I'm just going to say, if what I'm describing is intriguing, check it out. Like, it's the kind of movie where I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah.
It's
very much about the experience. Like,
it is.
What I do remember is, like, watching it and then after it was over being like, I kind of want to take a shower, actually.
It's that kind of movie. It makes you uncomfortable with the world and with yourself, and that's my favorite kind of movie.
I mean, it's a powerful experience.
It is.
And it's interesting to see, like, how that's conveyed, like, what the mechanisms of that are. The mystery of it, I guess. I don't know. I'm just saying stuff. Don't mind me.
Nightcrawler, I saw, and it immediately became one of my favorite movies. Just because it knows what it's doing and it does it so well that you get wrapped up in this world, and the thing that's really unsettling is it's a world that isn't necessarily familiar if you're not yourself involved in the things the film is describing, mm-hmm. but it very much lives in the world that we actually exist in.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is ultimately the most frightening about it, is you recognize midway through watching it that this could happen, and that there are people who fundamentally do what he does.
Mm-hmm. Who think like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really interesting. Did you see that guy's next movie? Denzel Washington, Roman J. Israel Esquire.
No.
Okay. It's kind of newish. I don't think it's out, on DVD yet. But
yeah, I remember being in the theaters recently.
Yeah, it wasn't as well received, but the trailers made me curious, especially based on the strength of Nightcrawler.
Right.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, that's Nightcrawler.
Okay. My first one is also a movie. In approaching this, I was like, okay, anti-hero, that's sort of fundamentally literary thing. So, let's kind of look up what some of the literary characteristics are. And, ended up on a bunch of different websites, kind of poking around. And, some of the things that I found were basically, okay, an anti-hero is driven or obsessed by past deeds and the power of fate. They might have a tragic flaw, but they might not. And especially in modern anti-heroes, that's, very scalar. A classical anti-hero, a tragic flaw would be, some epic, whereas, in a modern anti-hero, it's not. It could be anything, almost.
Mm-hmm.
An anti-hero potentially lacks a strong identity or, clear goals. It kind of depends on the flavor. I'd say somebody Lou Bloom definitely has goals in mind, but a different potential take on the anti-hero is someone who is, and this is the next point that I have written down, less active than reactive. Not necessarily for or against anything, but just, reacting to their present circumstances. And all of those things are kind of summed up in the, I suppose, most famous quote from the character that I have in mind. I wasn't even supposed to be here today.
I was almost gonna do that.
Well, he's such a dimple. And in case you're, either too young, too old, or live under a rock, we're talking about Dante from the movie Clerks. So first, a little bit about Clerks. It came out in 1994. It was written, directed, and co-stars Kevin Smith. The first production from VSQ Productions. It's kind of the movie that put Kevin Smith on the map, basically. It was part of the new wave of independent cinema that happened in the late 80s and early 90s with Soderbergh and Tarantino and all of that. But this was way on the low budget end of that. The shooting budget of it was $27,000. The post-production budget was $230,000. The gross was over $3 million. So it was definitely a success.
Yeah.
It stars Brian O'Halloran as Dante. Also stars Jeff Anderson, Marilyn Gigliotti, Lisa Spoonhour, Jason Mewes, and Kevin Smith. Quote, won some shit at Cannes and Sundance. And it basically tells the story of a guy who works at a convenience store in small town suburban New Jersey. I think I looked it up and the name of the town is Leonardo, New Jersey, which I think is a real place, but I'm not sure. I haven't been to New Jersey since I was a kid. He works at a convenience store, and he gets called in because another coworker's sick, and then finds out he has to stay all day because his boss left town, and basically spends most of the movie just kind of hanging out with the guy who works in the video store next door and does not give a fuck. There's a couple of weed dealers that are hanging out outside. He gets a visit from his girlfriend and his ex-girlfriend. At one point, he closes the store so they can play hockey on the roof. It's less of a plot-driven movie than it is driven by dialogue and by character.
Definitely.
So,
They go to a funeral at one point.
Yeah, they do. Knock over the casket, if I remember correctly. Yeah,
that's right.
Like, I meant to rewatch it to before this, but, like, I didn't quite get a chance. I might watch it this weekend, though, because it is a movie that I like a lot. But, like, okay, so Dante, obsessed with past deeds and fate, like, he's constantly pining over his ex-girlfriend and, like, what happened there. He's, like, super frustrated about, like, why me? Why am I here today? This isn't my job. Like, well, it is my job, but it's not my job right now. like, that kind of... not exactly helplessness, but, like, a lack of agency, mm-hmm. I guess, is a big part of who he is. And, like, that's... he is about addressing that in a lot of ways. Like, his girlfriend kind of takes him to task for that. It's like, you don't really want to do anything. All you do is talk shit about Star Wars all day. Like, that kind of thing. Like, he's not entirely good or evil. Like,
he's very true neutral.
Yeah, like, those are strong words for the subject matter that we're talking about. But, like, there's that scene at the end where Randall, the guy from the video store, like, basically just gets sick of his shit and is like, look at what you did today! Come on, like, you're not, like, some innocent victim or anything. You're, like, a fuck-up same as me, and it's fine. Like, I think the line is something like, if we're so fucking advanced, what are we doing working here?
Yeah.
And that kind of connects to... because what I was trying to do is, like, okay, like, what's the soul of an anti-hero? What's the essence of that? And one of the things that sort of leaked out at me about that was, like, this disjunction between their image of themselves and their behavior and who they actually are. There's kind of that schism, which sort of, like, almost kind of puts it in the space of an unreliable narrator, in a way. Like, it's like, this is somebody who... I'm not really sure how to sympathize with, because I don't know if I can trust their perceptions and their attitudes about what's going on. Also, another characteristic of anti-hero stories is they tend to have very irresolute endings, and Clerks kind of does. Like, some shit happens, and then he says he's gonna be better, and then the day's over, and that's it. And, like, you don't really see the follow-through, which I think is kind of also sort of a key component of it.
But what would you say to the original ending of the movie as far as that interpretation?
You're going to have to remind me what the original ending was.
Two dudes go into the convenience store, shoot Dante, he dies. Roll credits.
I don't know. Like, there's... I think there's a certain... in a way, that kind of feels like an imposition of judgment. Like, it feels like maybe the film taking a little bit more of a moral position. And I'm like, actually, you know what? Fuck this guy. But, I don't know. I would have to ponder that.
It's a... You can find that ending on YouTube. It's really bleak.
It sounds like
I mean, obviously, it's really bleak. But, like, Kevin Smith, like, they shot it, and he was like, okay, I imagined it being bleak, but this is even worse than I thought it was going to be.
Never mind. Bad idea. Back up.
Let's do something else.
So that's my first one.
Clerks, yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't having necessarily a difficult time coming up with examples. It was, like, a hard time coming up with examples I liked. Mm. So I just did a search for, like, anti-heroes. And Dante and Randall together were on one of the lists.
Randall kind of qualifies too. Although Randall to me feels like more... he's not so much he's more at peace with himself. He knows what he is, and he's just kind of going with it.
I always liked Randall and disliked Dante.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about Randall's...
he's way less whiny.
Like... he doesn't talk big philosophy very much, but the moments that he does, you can tell that he thought about it, and that he's serious about what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Dante's just like, I don't... this idea, I don't know anything.
Yeah.
It's harder to like Dante.
Yeah. Which,
He's kind of the point.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, cool. So for my next answer, I wanted to think about anti-heroes in sort of a different sense than just the way that they're presented as complex characters in a narrative.
Hi, Kenny.
I picked one of my favorite video games of all time. It's called Spec Ops The Line.
Oh, yes.
Spec Ops The Line came out in 2012 from a video game studio called Jaeger Studios. They were making the game for 2K Games. And 2K, the production of the game has actually got like kind of an interesting history to it, where a game came out in 1998 called Spec Ops Rangers Lead the Way. And it got an expansion, and then the following year they made a new game, which also got an expansion, and they just kept on making a new game and an expansion every year until 2002. And then they didn't touch the formula for 10 years.
Hmm.
So when 2K went to pick this up, it was sort of a, look, here's this franchise that is essentially dead, and which was never popular, really, in the first place.
Which basically means we can do anything we want with it.
We're going to let you completely reboot this. And Jaeger Studios just went hog wild with that. they proceeded
a
to...
A good term.
And I find this really entertaining. When you go to the Wikipedia page, series of Spec Ops games, it's literally a list of games with no information until you get to Spec Ops The Line, and then it has a paragraph explaining it, and just like, please click on this. This is what you meant.
Mm-hmm. Start here.
So, some fun facts about Spec Ops The Line. It was a colossal commercial failure. It was banned in the United Arab Emirates, and there was
never even
a question of a sequel being made.
But did it get an expansion?
It did not. Now, all of those things make this game sound like it should be just trash. But, here is how Spec Ops The Line works. Your mission is, it's you, Martin Walker, and you have two allies as part of your little Delta squad. Your allies are First Lieutenant Adam and Specialist Lugo. You can leave, Cat. Mm.
And he's gone.
So it's your three-man squad gets sent into Dubai to find survivors of a rogue United States military unit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you essentially spend the game exploring the city, trying to figure out what happened after that unit went rogue. But it's not the military gameplay that's really the point. In fact, this is a game that deliberately made its firefight mechanics as samey and boring as it possibly could to make a statement about other war games and how the same thing that you're doing over and over and over again isn't actually that interesting or worthwhile.
Yeah, you're pulling a trigger, basically.
Right. They actually created a mechanic where if you shoot somebody and they're not dead and they're just laying on the ground, you can go up and execute them. And that involves you, like, either shooting them in the head or, like, pounding their face into the dust or, like, just some really violent thing. And it gives you a bonus. It, like, gives you, it, like, refunds you ammo. And they said they were trying to do something like that as a mechanic that rewarded you for being brutal, because they knew what was going to happen later is they were going to make you rethink all that brutality.
Mm-hmm.
Because the point of this game is to follow its narrative, and its narrative is pretty anti-war.
It's very Heart of Darkness.
It's so Heart of Darkness, in fact, that the guy who you're trying to find, the guy who commanded this this battalion that went rogue, is named Conrad.
I didn't really make that connect that.
Yeah, like, they really went for it. You basically play Heart of Darkness, but in Dubai. The narrative pushes the gameplay, and it constantly jars your brain with a handful of different rules, or different mechanisms. One of them is hallucinations. Mm. At first it's subtle, and you don't realize that your character is hallucinating. You just think that things are happening that you need to respond to. In other cases, it will be something that's so overt that's impossible, it's clear that you're hallucinating. Another thing they do is overtly guilt you.
Yeah.
And that's not just with the narrative, but, like, loading screens initially will say things like, press A to jump.
Yeah, the sort of combat tips and stuff that you get in every video game.
Right, like, take cover to stay safe during a firefight. But then soon they become things like, how many American soldiers today? And the definition of cognitive dissonance is when your brain perceives something which is opposed to reality. Or, do you feel like a hero yet?
Yeah.
They also use time jumps. In fact, the very first thing that happens in the game is you're in a helicopter in some sort of a firefight during a sandstorm. And the first thing that you say is, no, this isn't right, we've already done this. Which doesn't make a lot of sense. But then your helicopter crashes at the end of the sequence, and you start at the actual beginning of the game. And at the climax of the game, you find yourself in this helicopter doing the same exact thing, screaming, this isn't right, we've already done this.
Yeah, that. I forgot about that.
And they institute other changes in gameplay, which are meant to imply cognitive dissonance. Things like giving you a clear binary choice, and then not to that you actually have a third, or in some cases even a fourth choice to respond with.
Like with the two bodies hanging down?
That
was one of those, if I remember.
Without spoiling anything, there comes a point where you're asked to decide between shooting a civilian who stole water or the military operative who caught that guy and killed his family for stealing water. You can kill either of them, but there's also two other things that you can do which are not explained to you at all.
Mm.
So the story itself is really rich with these philosophical conundrums, especially on the topics of war. They talk about the individual, they talk about perception. One of my favorite elements of the game is the fact that every time that you do something, you immediately have to traverse some type of terrain that takes you downhill.
Mm, yeah.
In fact, you're almost
constantly
always
descending.
Like, you'll start on the top of a skyscraper and, like, rappel to a different, shorter building, and then go down 8 stories in that building, and then get into a sewer system and go down even further, and when you come out, you're on top of a skyscraper?
And it's like, it's done in such a way that, like, if you hadn't pointed it out to me before I started playing the game, I don't know that I would have noticed it right away. Like,
I didn't notice it the first time I played. I had to have a critic point it out. But it gets that Heart of Darkness constant descent into the gameplay. I actually was lucky enough to present at a video game symposium on the topic of meta-narrative in Spec Ops.
Mm-hmm.
And I focused a lot on how Conrad speaks directly to the player. Like I mentioned a moment ago, Conrad, commander of the Rogue Battalion.
Yeah, the Colonel Kurtz.
He says things to you through Martin Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, that's how games work. They communicate to the main character, which then communicates to you what you need to do. But he stops communicating things that are actually gameplay influenced. He starts saying things to you like, you came here because you wanted to feel like something you're not. A hero. And it, sure, that can be interpreted for Walker as, I came here to save people and all I've done is destroy their lives.
Yeah, everything.
The whole city at one point.
Yeah.
But it also is very pointedly aimed at you, the player. You sat down to play a war game so that you could feel like a hero, and all this game is doing is reminding you you're not a hero, you're a war criminal.
Yeah, like I remember the kind of tip-off for that to me that I found interesting was, like, when you first load it up and it's doing, like, all the credits and everything, like, if you're logged into PSN, in my case, I don't know, is it on different systems? It must be.
It is. They have it for Xbox and Mac now, even.
Yeah, but, like, whatever you're logged into while you're playing the game, like, it includes your screen name in the credits.
Yeah.
For that. Like, it's making you a part of it in a really interesting way.
It's a fascinating game. The critical response to Spec Ops The Line is unlike anything I've seen for a video game in recent times. Like, I know I talked about Superhot last week. Superhot was very reviewed because people in there saying it does something that shooters never do. It's so innovative, it's crazy, you gotta check it out. When critics responded to Spec Ops, they weren't using the vocabulary of this is a good game. They were elevating it past the point of this is when we talk about games. This is a piece of art that is a video game. And frankly, the reason that I first played it in the first place was watching a video game critic, Yahtzee Croshaw, who I was really, really into at the time. He basically stopped midway through his review and said, I don't do this, but go play the game. Like, I'm not going to spoil anything, just go play the game. I'll give my review of it, but seriously, go play the game. And it got me interested enough that I checked it out, and it's a game that I've now played, like, 3 or 4 times through to completion. And
it's not super long, either, which is nice.
Yeah, you can knock most of the game out in between 5 and 10 hours, depending on how quickly you play, which is kind of nice. There's also a chapter select function, which is helpful because there's multiple segments of the game where there's, like, choices offered to you, as I mentioned. Sometimes they're simple, like, do you let a guy, like, die in pain or do you end his suffering? But the very end of the game allows you to either kill yourself, wait for backup to arrive, kill the backup, or turn yourself over and be arrested by the backup. Or get killed by the backup. Those are all different endings.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating as a game that deliberately makes its gameplay samey and uninteresting, just as a commentary on shooters. But when we started talking about anti-heroes, it's literally a game that constructs, here is someone who is heroic, but also an anti-hero, and the point of this is to make you feel the weight of being the anti-hero in the game with and for him.
Yeah, like, it's very much about the concept of a hero.
Yeah. So that's Spec Ops The Line. It's like $10 or less on wherever you find it.
I found it in a Fred Meyer bargain bin for like $7. It was a good investment.
Check it out.
Okay. I thought about doing a video game for my second one, but in the end I ended up going with a novel. And the character in that novel that I'm referring to is Charles Kinsey. Of Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire. So, this is a book that I read last summer in Michigan, actually, when I was out there. So it's like sitting on a beach reading this, like, Mobius strip of a book. Pale Fire was published in 1962, and it takes the structure of a 1,000-line poem written by a character within the novel named John Shade. And it's a pretty decent poem. It's, you know, about life and the death of his daughter and all this kind of stuff. One of Nabokov's, like, most quoted lines, which, of course, are couplets, which I can't remember the second half of now, of course, but it's, like, something like, I was the shadow of the waxwing slain something about a window pane. You know, like, it's not a bad poem. There's some stuff going on there. But the bulk of the novel is presented as a introduction and critical analysis to the extent that, like, it's written entirely in endnotes, pretty much.
Huh.
Written by one Charles Kinbote, a neighbor of, or Kinbote, I don't really know how you would say it. It's, you know, that case of, like, you only ever see a word written, and English in particular is such a weird-ass language, who knows.
It's always tough with novels, too.
Yeah.
It's like, no one has ever heard this pronounced out loud.
Right. But, okay, so Charles K. is a neighbor of John Shade. He's also, like, an academic colleague. Like, they work at the same university and everything. He's a friend, in quotes. And in the course of this commentary, like, he basically is asserting that this novel, or this poem, rather, is, like, this actually, like, deeply coded historical biography about the exiled king of a country called Zembla, which is, like, kind of pseudo-Nordic, I guess. And it also, like, he is that exiled king, and John Shade was, like, writing a poem about him and his life, but, like, it takes kind of a minute to get there, and at first you're, like, not really sure if that's what he's implying, and then it becomes more explicit, but, like... Okay, so first of all, there's the question of, like, does Zembla even exist? Because the book is set in a town in New England, ostensibly in our world, but, like, it's never quite clear, like... It's an epistemological nightmare, so it's kind of difficult to describe. But basically, it's like, okay, there's, okay, one, Charles is who he's claiming to be. Everything he's saying is correct. He's still kind of like an arrogant asshole, but he's believable, at least. That's possibility number one. Possibility number two is... he is, in fact, the king of Zembla, but he is totally projecting this shit onto his neighbor, who really only kind of puts up with him and tolerates him and is definitely not writing his life story. Three, Charles is crazy. Zembla does not exist. He has made up this fantasy world and has involved his neighbor in it. Four, his neighbor does not exist. Charles wrote the poem and is using it to justify this elaborate fantasy life, or this real life, maybe. Who the fuck knows? Five, Charles does not exist, and John is actually writing the commentary in this other persona. Or, and this is apparently kind of the interpretation that Nabokov was like, hey, yeah, think about that. It could be this entirely other person, who's just kind of in the background of the story, like another professor at the university. Like, as you're going through it, you're kind of put into this position where you're forced to question the meaning of everything that you're being told. And it doesn't really quite land anywhere, which is really fascinating. But Charles himself is a really interesting character because, like I said, even if you completely take him at his word and, you know, believe everything he's saying, like, he's not a sympathetic person. Like, he's kind of myopic and narcissistic and just, you know, claims he's so beloved and thinks he's better than everybody and makes snide comments to everyone and is just, like, horribly rude to John Shade's wife and everybody else, pretty much. Like, he's just kind of a dick. Which is maybe kind of, like, a tragic flaw, in a way. It's like he legitimately doesn't seem to realize that he's not connecting, like, when it's clear that he wants to. Like, he wants to establish these connections with the people in the world around him, but whether it's because of his background or whether because he's just fucking crazy, he's unable to really do that, and it's kind of painful to watch, read, whatever. Another characteristic of the anti-hero that I kind of didn't mention before was, like, whether intentionally or not, causes harm to himself, the community, and others. And this is very much the case. John Shade is eventually shot in the book. Spoiler. not much of a spoiler, because you kind of get told that at the beginning. But, again, it's not really clear, like, did Charles himself do the shooting? Was the shooting entirely unrelated and he just kind of wrapped it up into his world? Was he supposed to be the target of the assassination? But, like, even, I mean, that's the most dramatic example, but even in, like, smaller ways, like, his presence is disruptive. Like, he's fucking with the natural order of things. And even if it's not entirely clear how, because you don't know what to make of him as a character. He's very reactive in that, like, which is kind of weird to say about somebody who, like, is so kind of self-obsessed, I guess, in a way. But, like, he doesn't really seem to be clear about anything. He's just kind of devouring. Like, everything becomes part of this narrative about, like, the coup in this castle and, like, escaping through the mountains and coming to America and becoming a respected professor and, like, clearly the most important and insightful critic on this writer's work because he knew him personally and they shared something deep with one another. Like, he's unable to look at himself. And so he's kind of unable to move himself forward. He's definitely obsessed. He's obsessed with John. He's obsessed with this idea of, like, nobility and exile. He's obsessed with his own importance. And then sort of the last bullet point that I have here is lacks a strong identity because, duh. the engine of the novel is, like, in a classical story, the hero is someone that you are obviously meant to empathize with. Whereas in this book, it's kind of hard to do that because you can't find your footing, and, like, even when you do, he's a shit. So it's less about, like, a direct empathy than more just trying to, kind of like what you were talking about with Nightcrawler, where you're trying to, like, pick apart what's going on and figure out, like, what is driving this person? What's really happening here? What is the end? Like, where I keep using that word, but I like it for this. Like, what is what pushes this forward? To figure him out. And, like, that is also a kind of sympathy, but it's a more complex sympathy than a standard hero kind of generally asks for. It's a way of, like, acknowledging complexity and difficulty in this idea of, like, okay, this is the protagonist of this story, according to him, but is that really true? Where do I stand as a reader in relationship to that?
Yeah.
And, like, that seems, like, very much at the core of, like, what an antihero is meant to do. It causes you, like, either to sympathize and then immediately question that sympathy, or to, like, question, like, why you're supposed to sympathize, or, like, sympathize without even realizing that you're doing it. Like, it's a more nuanced construction.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Have you used at one point the phrase epistemological nightmare? And I feel like it's a little bit late, but that would have been a great show title. Welcome to Epistemological Nightmare.
I mean, it still can be the title. that would be, like, a fun show unto itself. File that away idea for later. Like, what's something where, like, you don't really know what's going on? And my thing of the week is going to play into that.
Oh.
But that's later.
That'll be one to think hard about. For my last entry, I thought it would be interesting to go with a real-life anti-hero.
Mm.
So, I'm reading a book, which is a biography, of William Tecumseh Sherman. Okay. One of the great anti-heroes in real life history.
This is very true.
So, Citizen Sherman is a book that came out in 1995 by a historian named Michael Fellman. This is a book which begins with the very early years of Sherman's life, traces through his young adulthood up to his military career, and then everything afterwards. There's particular attention paid to his military career, but I'd say it's about a third of the book.
Mm-hmm.
About a third of it is pre-war life, and about a third of it is after, post-war life. Let me give you some facts about Sherman and why I think he is a representative of the anti-hero in real life. I'm going to start early. He was born in 1820. Before the war, he tried and failed his hand at businesses in three different industries, at least. So he enlisted in the military in 1840 and served in the Mexican-American War doing administrative duties. This seriously upset him. He wanted to go off and prove his mettle in war. He wanted to gain medals for valor. And mostly he sat behind a desk in California.
Mm.
So he ended up marrying his foster sister and resigning from the army and becoming a bank manager. Which,
why not?
Yeah, that whole trio of things. Just standard midlife crisis.
Yep, you know.
Marry your sister, resign from the army, become a bank manager. It was going reasonably well for him until his bank relocated him to New York, at which point the bank failed completely anyway. So he became a lawyer, at which he also failed. He began teaching at a military college, which would later become Louisiana State University. And that was all good until the Civil War was about to start, at which point he was too northern for the southerners and too southern for the northerners, so he just kind of like, hey, I'll do whatever I have to do if you'll let me serve in the military.
Yeah.
So in the early Civil War, he was pretty quickly promoted to Brigadier General of Volunteers by Lincoln personally.
Hmm. Based on what?
He served very well under Grant in the Tennessee chapter of the war in 61 and early 62.
Just kind of fell into it. Like,
yeah.
found his niche.
He finally found his thing, and his thing was killing a bunch of dudes with the lives of other dudes.
Yeah, everybody's got to be good at something.
And that really messed with him, and in fact he had a colossal mental breakdown.
Like you do.
And he was replaced by another general, and he just kind of hung out in a mental institution for the better part of a year. And what ended up happening while he was there was he funneled all of his anger, his frustration, his failures into a new philosophy. And that philosophy was, war is all destruction. There's no way around it. So you just have to convince the other side it's more costly for them than it is for you. And how do you do that? You scorch the fucking earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he became the institution that he called hard war.
As opposed to all that soft and gentle war.
Right. Now he's like, Fuck all the killing. It's time for hard war.
Ultra killing.
So he re-entered the army, and part of his struggle was he had been a very protective commander. He never wanted his troops to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
People who are familiar with the Civil War will be like, oh, McClellan did that. Yeah, except for McClellan, when he got pushed and shoved, just kept protecting his troops. And Sherman was like, they'll think I'm crazy if I don't plunge in real hard.
Yes. So they'll think you're crazy if you don't.
Yeah. So he plunged in real hard. A lot of people know Sherman. I'd say if you know him, you probably know him for the March to the Sea. Uh-huh. Now, they talk in this book about how the March to the Sea is actually pretty greatly exaggerated. He made it very clear to his men they were not to harm civilians, and they were not to take things from civilians aside from food. That was literally the... And they had to pick it from the crop fields themselves. It wasn't like raid their barns, raid their homes. And the records that we have show that his men actually listened to him, and they didn't go around destroying shit they didn't need to destroy. It was just military outposts, railroads, and, like, taking crops, essentially. Crops sent off to the Confederate Army.
Sure.
Now, the war is basically the height of his anti-hero-ness, where he's this figure who is, really just ruled by his own inner turmoil, and he finds that he is at his strongest when he is his most ruthless. This is pretty typical anti-hero stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the war, he continues his anti-hero stuff in, like, a peaceful way. He became the general of the whole army after, Grant became the president.
Mm-hmm.
They needed a new guy. So his job for, like, 20 years was just to be the head of the army and to, like, be the guy who everyone thanked for there being peace. And he would lavish all of these, like, gifts and speeches and all the shit that he could come up with. Like, he did it all for his men. They called him Uncle Billy. Like, he was very well-loved. He was so well-loved, in fact, that people kept on telling him he should run for president. At least for some political office.
Yeah.
His response was, I am the guy in Washington who people come to ask questions about the military. I don't like Washington people. I just don't. I'm not going to play their game even greater than I have to.
Fair enough.
So he outright refused for the rest of his life to be a political anything. He just liked being involved in the military where he was really well loved. And that's the interesting thing about this book, is the author looks at like thousands of pages of handwritten letters and journals and all this stuff. And what he finds over and over again is that this guy just had, like, the frailest of egos. Like, the kind of ego that would be destroyed because someone said a mean thing about you when you're in the army and you have a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
The kind of guy who would avoid ever trying something more difficult than serving in the army. Not to say that that's not a difficult thing.
Sure.
But he never tried anything beyond just being the figurehead of the army. Probably because he just liked being adored and didn't want to try any harder. In particular, he says that the place where you can see this sort of glass ego is in the marrying of his foster sister.
Mm.
Someone who was around, someone who he trusted, someone who he didn't really have to try to get the affection of.
That's a point.
What
was her stake in that, I wonder?
He was going places. Like, he was kind of the most... Well, like, one, I think he was the only male child of his family, so it was a matter of he's the only one who's really going to make something of himself at the time. 1860s, folks. Woo! But it was also, I mean, like, they apparently had a genuine bond. They weren't blood-related, and it didn't seem weird to them, necessarily.
I mean, I guess standards were different.
They were. And in the book, there's so many letters reproduced where you get to know the way that he talks to his military men, how he talks to his family, how he talks to his wife. And he writes some really beautiful letters to his wife. Like, he's known for his sense of humor, like a really rough, like, he'll make a joke, like, oh yeah, we really showed it to them Southerners. Yeah, we just tore everything down. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, you destroyed the infrastructure of the South for like 20 years. Yeah,
yeah, they still remember that shit.
Oh boy, do they. But then, like, he'll turn around and write these really, like, delicate letters to his sister wife. Like, he wrote at one point in when he was 29 years old. Though, and this was, I guess, like, just after he had left the military and had failed at law and in the banking industry. Though my hopes in life are all destroyed, my love for you has never abated, never waned in the least, and upon it you may constantly rely. He's an interesting figure. I've had a sort of been with Sherman for as long as I can remember. I got really into the Civil War when I was a kid, and there's something about him as a figure, as someone who kind of figured, if we're going to war, let's get it over with as soon as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. And he did it in one of the most morally questionable ways possible.
Yeah. It seemed to work, though.
It worked exceedingly well. Like I said, he destroyed very little on his actual march to the sea.
Yeah.
It was a psychological issue, and he knew it was a psychological. He wrote it. This is a psychological warfare and not a physical one.
And it turned the whole thing from what I remember from growing up in Virginia and absorbing the Civil War that way. It's like that was kind of the moment where the South started slipping, basically.
Yeah, it was the combination of Grant waging this really heartless war, letting whole scores of his own men die just to hold positions and keep the strategic points where they needed to be, completely divorced from the idea of losing soldiers, and Sherman just saying, we're just gonna fuck with them. Like, we're just gonna destroy their will to fight.
Yeah, I remember hearing a fact at some point, and like, I don't know, this may be apocryphal, but it seems like the kind of thing that would be legit. Like, one of the things his army would do is, like, they would break people's pencils and stuff like that, so that they couldn't write letters and communicate as effectively, because you couldn't just, like, go down to Walmart and get a 50-pack of pencils. Like,
right.
That really screwed with you. Like, stuff like that.
I have never heard that, but I like that. That's very much the kind of thing that he would have done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say people interested in the Civil War in general, Citizen Sherman is a fantastic book to give you a profile on one of the more interesting psychological figures to come out of it. But even if you're not, and you just kind of want to know more about someone who had such a role in the history of our country and what psychologically makes someone the way that he was, it's academic, but not academic to the point where it's gonna keep you from reading it.
Yeah.
That's my real life anti-hero.
Yeah. My third one is also a real person. He is was an artist. An artist that I find far more fascinating than palatable. And that kind of, that gets into that sort of complicated evocation of sympathy that I was talking about. I'm going to talk about G.G. Allen. So, G.G. Allen, for anybody not familiar, was a musician. He was born in 1956 in New Hampshire. He died in 1993 in Manhattan of a heroin overdose. He's probably most famous generically for being, like, kind of in the punk canon, I guess. Like, he also did country stuff, he did spoken word stuff. Like, there's a surprising amount of variety for the crudeness of the execution. Like, and some of the songs are really catchy, actually. But there is this other side to them. To put it delicately, he was very much about pushing boundaries.
That's a very gentle way to put it.
Yeah, that's me being diplomatic. It would not be unheard of to have actual shit thrown at you at a Gigi Allen show, or various other bodily fluids. He would self-harm on stage. He would harm other people. His songs are... Well... Okay. Let me lead into this a little bit. The dude was definitely unstable. Like, that seems like pretty much a given. And this is one of those facts that, like, I read and then I, like, tried to find... Like, wait, no, that can't... Come on. That can't be true. But I couldn't find anything to directly contradict it. Like, I'm wary of being credulous in the age that we live in. But apparently he was born Jesus Christ Allen. So, kind of didn't have a chance. Definitely a heavy drug user. Famous for... violence, like being just kind of part of his world and thing that he did. A lot of like homophobic shit, racist shit, misogynistic shit. The sort of the recommended album, I guess, is called Freaks, Faggots, Drunks, and Junkies, which came out in 1988, by the way. Song titles include, but are not limited to by any means, No Room for a Racial Epithet That I'm Not Gonna Say. I'm Gonna Rape You. 10-Year-Old Fuck, which is about what you think it is. But also, like, there's this other side to that. Because, like, you also get song titles like Abuse Me, I Want to Die, A Fuck Up, Self-Absorbed, etc., etc., that kind of convey this consciousness of, like, yeah, I'm just going balls out. I'm doing all this, like, fucked up shit, but, like, it's coming from this place of, like, it's, I don't know how to say it exactly. It's, like, focusing outward instead of focusing inward because I can't. Like, that's the vibe that I get from it. Like, mm-hmm. What I can bring myself to listen to of it. So it's, like, it raises this interesting question when you look at somebody like that. It's, like, where does the put-on end and the really fucked up shit begin? And, like, because there's clearly... I mean, there's definitely an element of somebody trying to cope with mental illness there. There was a quote that I read, and I wish I had written down where it came from. I didn't, so I couldn't say for sure. But something to the effect of, like, if I weren't a musician, I'd probably be a serial killer. Like, that kind of thing.
What self-awareness.
Yeah, so it's like, are you channeling this experience to cope with it, or, like, is it a kind of, like, Bill Hicks-style confrontational put-on? Like, the persona clearly exists, and you're also embracing it, and it's kind of both, and, like, even within the persona itself, like, is it, like, a confrontation? Confrontationalist absurdism that's, like, intellectualized? Is it, like, a kind of artistic anarchism? Or is it an excuse to get wasted and be a violent fuck-up? Like, I don't know. I legitimately, I can't put a beat on it. And that's what's fascinating to me. So, like, that inability to, like, really nail it down is very much kind of the essence of the anti-hero concept. Like, it's... What I have written is, like, paralytic, damaging, and inconclusive aspect of its necessity and inevitability of complexity. So it's, like... I don't know what to make of it. And that... I'm kind of stuttering here because it's like there is a part of me that wants to respect it Because, like, if you read, like, the G.G. Allin Manifesto and, like, you know, kind of read between the lines of some of the lyrics or, like, watch him in interviews, like, there's clearly some intelligence and some thought and, like, some legitimate, like, this shit is fucked up. Why are we doing this? What if I turn this back around on you? That kind of thing. And, like, that does appeal to me. I mean, like, that's part of the reason Naked Lunch is such a great book, because it's absurdism. That's what it is. It's throwing it back in your face, and there's something very powerful about that. There's something to be said for that. But at the same time, like, this is a guy who went to jail for, like, doing grievous bodily harm to a woman, and I can't get behind that. Mm-hmm. And, like, the fact that I catch myself, like, sympathizing with him when I'm hearing him speak, like, makes me feel uncomfortable. And if that's not what an antihero is supposed to do, then I don't know what an antihero is supposed to do, you know?
Yeah. My introduction to G.G. Allin was through Patton Oswalt, who talked about the notion that he, when he was young, would get into, like, the most edgy, bizarre acts that he could find.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, and when I found G.G. Allin.
Yeah, it's...
And he just kind of stands there silently for a couple seconds.
Lets it fall in.
I don't even know about G.G. Allin.
I don't think anybody does. It's kind of... I don't know.
There's something so very off-putting about someone who has that level of disconnection from the reality the rest of them live in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like a light bulb to a bunch of moths. Like, oh, we don't have to be like this? I mean, I don't know like that necessarily, but you're definitely different from the way we do things.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if we could be different and just not that different. It's difficult because he's...
Right. And like, whether or not you can like make these like artistic or intellectual justifications for it, or whether you just want to be like, no, fuck that, fuck everybody like that, like, it's still a thing that exists. Like, you kind of, you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of the mindset that it's like, all right, that is an opportunity for an artistic exploration, like, in the sense that, like, you have to work with art. It's not something that just exists on its own. It's about the interaction between it and you. And, I don't know, that's what I find cool about that. Like...
Yeah. Well, there's some anti-heroes for you folks.
Yeah. That one pretty well. That was a good one.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between a good one for the listeners and a good one for us.
Yeah. I don't know, there's times, like, last week sometimes I caught myself not really knowing what to say a lot, and then, like, this time it came a little more easily, so that's sort of the marker that I'm using.
There you go. What's your weekly recommendation?
I got a couple. So, first, just musically, I've been listening to Eamon Dunes a lot lately. I played some of that for you. This is a band, I think he's based in, like, New York now, but he's also, like, from Philadelphia and lived in China for a while. Has four albums. I've really mostly listened to the last two. I'm kind of working my way backwards. They're, like, it's basically, like, psychedelic rock, but the last two albums, which are 2014's Love and 2018's Freedom, are very different. Like, Love is very hazy guitars, and it's a little bit more acoustic, and, like, there's way more reverb, and it's kind of this, like, droney, late summery sunset kind of sound. And then Freedom is, like, the night after that. Like, the one of the singles off it, Blue Rose, is, like, almost could be a George Michael song, which is not something you can usually say about a psych rock band on a goth label, but there you go. It's really good. It's kind of hard to describe, but check it out. Freedom is probably the most accessible, so start there. The other thing is a TV show that I was kind of averse to on the basis of cape fatigue, basically, which is a term that I heard somewhere. I don't remember where, but I like it a lot. But I decided to check it out because the AV Club had an article where they called it the most stylistically aggressive show on television. And I was like, all right, what the fuck does that mean? So I sat down to watch Legion, which is based on some Marvel comics by Chris Claremont and another guy whose name I don't remember. I only know the name Chris Claremont because, like, I lived with a guy who was, like, into comics for a while, and that was a name he said a lot. It's kind of a spinoff of the X-Men. It's about a guy who thinks he's schizophrenic but might just have powers. And it sort of goes from there. It stars Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey, and, like, he was the boyfriend in Colossal, too, I think.
Yeah.
Aubrey Plaza's in it. Gene Smart is in it. Jemaine Clement shows up. Like, it's an interesting cast. It's also, like, very fundamentally not interested in establishing an objective point of view, which I like. And the moment, like, I watched the first episode and had this moment where I was like, ooh, that was interesting, but fuck, that was a lot. I don't know. Like, I'm not getting a payoff from this yet if I'm going to be into this. And then I watched, like, a couple more episodes and was like, okay, I'm starting to get the vibe a bit. And then, like, the first scene of episode 4 is what really sold me on it. Because it comes kind of apropos of nothing. But, I don't know, I'm going to show it to you in a minute. But check it out. It's weird, but it's pretty good. It was created, incidentally, by Noah Hawley, who also did the Fargo, which was also really fucking good. So, like, those are my things.
Ah, damn. My recommendation this week is one I'm pulling out of the old bag. There's a game I've been playing for years called Mini Metro, which I have fallen back into playing recently. It is the ultimate chill-out game. The concept of this game is you're given a map.
Okay.
On the map are a number of shapes. Usually start with three. A square, a circle, and triangle. You then have metro lines, which you can connect between the stops. And trains will go back and forth, delivering people to each stop. You need to make sure that there's a possible way for each, like, little stop to connect to each other stop, either through a line or on the same line, so that people can get to and from. As the game progresses, more stops appear in different shapes. They're sort of meant to represent, like, oh, all circles are residential areas, and all triangles are shopping areas, and, like, squares are city centers, and then you have weird stuff like stars and, like, teardrops and pentagons meant to represent, like, other, like, specific, like, oh, that one's a sports center. In any case, it has some of the simplest play I've ever seen, but it actually took me about 3 months of playing the game to even realize that if you were to make sure that each line, like, connected circle to triangle to, like, something else, you would keep your train from getting overloaded. Because it will only drop, you know, you can only carry so many people until you've cleared them off. It is another incredibly cheap game on Steam. It's so addictive, so simple, and in its way, like, charmingly beautiful.
Yeah, I do love a simple meditative game.
You can play through, I mean, depending on how well you're doing on the map, and what speed setting you have it on, you can play through an entire game in, like, at most 15 minutes. Or, I mean, if you're, like, going really far, you could stretch it to, like, half an hour, but that is tough. Let me tell you. Mini Metro, definitely worth a look. Another thing that's interesting about it is each map that you play has tendencies that are actually unique to the city. So if you play in Okinawa, for instance, there's lots of rivers and bays that you have to deal with. Whereas if you play in Washington, D.C., it's more of a matter of connecting the whole mass of stops to one another.
Yeah. Having ridden the D.C. Metro, that is an experience.
Yeah. So that's my weekly recommendation.
Alright. Cool.
That does it for this week. What is our topic next week, sir?
Oh god, I don't know.
I know I mentioned a while ago a world building, like, what's the most interesting world building you've seen in a thing.
Okay.
Although that one's like a lot of work.
It's pretty open ended, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. We could narrow it down, like, facet of world building. Like,
right.
This is a particularly cool way that this works in this world.
Yeah.
But I don't think we have to be specific about that. I don't know. We'll ponder
that.
How
about something that it requires patience to get through?
Oh. Okay. That's...
I feel like this is generally the kind of thing that both of us are, like, interested in anyway.
Yeah, and it's kind of open-ended, because, like, what requires patience about it? Okay, yes, I like it. Patience. Speaking of patience, thank you for being patient with us and listening to this. Yeah, pithy statement about anti-heroes.
It takes one to know one?
Maybe? I don't know.
I don't think it does.
No, probably not.
I'm glad that I'm going to be editing this episode. There's going to be a lot of shit I need to cut myself out. It's like, no, it was a good try. It wasn't a good try.
We should get a trombone sound effect. And on that note...
Yeah, thanks for listening. This has been another episode of Does It Matter? / Epistemological Nightmare.